Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I'm your host, Mike Cutler. It's a delight to join you this Friday, March the 2nd. Spring almost upon us, although it's been a very mild winter here in New York. An easy winter for us so far, but I don't want to speak too soon. Hope you've all had a good week. It's always good to join you at the end of the week to play a little bit of catch-up at all the madness that's going on in the world. Those of you familiar with this program who are familiar with me know that I'm a retired senior special agent of what used to be the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Now that job, that mission is being carried out allegedly, and I do say allegedly, by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a division of an agency that, unfortunately, I've had to call the Department of Homeland Surrender. We have millions of illegal aliens in our country today. We have no idea as to who they are. And what disturbs me is that the open borders anarchists, the immigration anarchists, if you will, call the illegal aliens immigrants. And I think it really has a negative connotation for the true immigrants, aliens who have been lawfully admitted into our country, who are abiding by the laws, who are doing what is supposed to be done as best they can, because even the legal system lacks integrity. I keep hammering the point that it's not just the border with Mexico that we have to worry about. It's the Canadian border, not that Canada is a bad country, or even that Mexico is, the Mexicans are bad. But we do know that there's a serious crime problem in Mexico and a corruption problem in Mexico. Thankfully, that's not the case where Canada is concerned. You know, I worked for the INS for 30 years. I had the privilege of working for many, many years with members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP, members of state law enforcement agencies of Canada who are every bit as trustworthy and professional and conscientious as are the best that America has to offer. But it's a matter of international borders posing a threat. That we know that criminals and terrorists travel internationally to aid law enforcement and to go about preparations, whether it's for carrying out a terrorist attack or smuggling contraband or being involved in criminal activities. So we really need to have a secure border that protects our country, that protects Canada. And if you look at the lunacy, Fast and Furious, the alleged ATF investigation, I certainly don't think of it as an investigation, where we gave at least 2,000 high-powered weapons to Mexico. Mexico should want to have a secure border with the United States, and in fact they do. I can assure you that the Mexican government takes their borders a heck of a lot more seriously than we do. Arguably, of all the countries in the world, the United States is among the worst at securing its own border, and it makes no sense because it's along the Mexican border, as somebody very wisely pointed out not long ago, that you see the first world and the third world in collision. And boy, is there a collision going on. There's violence spilling across the border. Last week, I was invited to provide an op-ed piece for Fox News Latino about the spillover of violence. And, of course, Janet Napolitano, the head of DHS, said, oh, there's no spillover. This woman that was shot in the leg in El Paso while pushing a baby stroller, that was an isolated incident. Never mind that Brian Terry was shot to death, Border Patrol agent, American hero. He's also a member of the military. Never mind that Rob Krentz, a rancher on the border, was shot in the back, probably as he was offering water to illegal aliens. Never mind that hundreds of American cities have become infested by the Mexican cartels. So we have the open borders crowd using the term immigrant to describe illegal aliens. People who are lawful immigrants, I think, are getting a bum rap because people are very suspect that anybody who's here might be here illegally because it is so prevalent. We're told there's probably 11 million illegal aliens in the United States. Well, in point of fact, I'm willing to bet that there's at least two or three times as many as the official estimates would have us believe. And this isn't about scapegoating or vilifying anybody. For those of you who are familiar with what I've been talking about over the years and writing about and providing testimony before a whole bunch of congressional hearings and when I've gone before state legislative hearings, you need look no further than the immigration laws to understand that the immigration laws are designed to prevent the entry of aliens into our country who would pose a problem. It starts out with a list of aliens who are excludable, aliens who we're supposed to keep out. And for the first 4 years of my career, that's in fact what I did. I was an immigration inspector assigned to Kennedy Airport. And the list begins with aliens with communicable diseases, aliens who suffer extreme mental illness and are prone to violence, or sex offenders, aliens who are convicted felons, members of violent gangs, narcotics traffickers, human smugglers, war criminals, human rights violators, money launderers. The list goes on. And to have our own government tell us that it's not a big deal when aliens violate the inspections process that's supposed to keep aliens who pose a threat to our safety and well-being out of the country is unfathomable. It's unfathomable that we have candidates for the presidency talking about how they want to create jobs, but not talking about how they want to liberate jobs. The way you liberate a job, by the way, is you get rid of the illegal aliens who should not be working here. This is what the law requires. This is what common sense should dictate. We have so many millions of Americans who are out of work. And even there, the government does a great job of cooking the books. Enron couldn't cook the books any better than the federal government does in so many ways. And you look at the unemployment rate, oh, it's about 9%, give or take. Yeah, give or take what? Give or take American dreams that are smashed? Because let's face it, people who've been out of work for more than a couple of years go off the rolls and off the radar scope. You know, it's the old story of figures don't lie, but liars can figure. And these are serious issues because as Americans lose their jobs, they're losing their homes to foreclosure. And as more Americans lose their homes to foreclosure and go through that trauma, that undoubtedly, by the way, will forever impact the psyche of the children of families that are that wind up homeless. I mean, think of what a traumatic experience that has to be for a child, living with his mom and dad and their pets and everything is fine, and then one day they are thrown out of their own homes because the parents, through no fault of their own, lose their jobs. Perhaps the dogs have to be put up for adoption or brought to an animal shelter. The kids' world is turned upside down. But when we talk about American kids, nobody seems to want to listen. We hear about the DREAM Act. Oh, we've got to help the children, illegal aliens. And by the way, I understand that when aliens run the border who are desperate for a job or food that they're starving in their home countries, don't misunderstand me. Those folks are not my enemy, but they are a problem. When I was an immigration agent, I spent a number of years working on conducting investigations into businesses that intentionally employed illegal aliens. These folks are being hammered from every direction, the illegal aliens who work in our country, the ones who don't get involved with other criminal activities. And many of them don't get involved with serious criminal activities. They're desperate. And they're desperate because their own government doesn't care that they starve. Mexico has one of the most vibrant economies in the Western Hemisphere, but they love to send their population here. In fact, it's estimated that at least 10% of Mexicans now live in the United States. That's why whenever there's an election for the presidency of Mexico, they campaign inside the United States. Because by sending their people here, the Mexican government minimizes the potential for insurrection because the people who come here are generally young, able-bodied men. These are the guys that will be storming the gates if they couldn't get to the United States. And when they send money home, it helps to supplement the economy of Mexico. In fact, the remittances wired from the United States to Mexico, from the most recent studies that I've seen, make it the second most lucrative source of income for the Mexican economy. It's money being drained out of our economy, over $20 billion a year, money that's permanently lost to our economy. So Mexico makes out, and we get hammered. But the people that come here are being victimized and exploited. None of this is good for them. It's not good for American citizens, but it is good for Mexican's oligarchy, the people at the top. And it's good for the bankers who get a piece of the action by moving the money remitters. It's good for the immigration lawyers. It's good for the advocacy groups. I wrote an article for the Social Contract. And, in fact, I'm going to be it's going to be published shortly. We have a caller. Let me see who's on the line. We're expecting to visit with Dave Stoddard today. Dave is a retired Border Patrol supervisor. Let me see if this, in fact, is Dave. Hang on, folks. Hi, you're talking to Mike Cutler. Who's this?
This is Dave, Mike. You guessed
there
right.
There you are, Dave Stoddard. I thought it was you. I I saw it said unknown, and I said, well, there must be the unknown Dave Stoddard. How are you this evening?
It's good to be unknown sometimes.
Sometimes anonymity is a good thing. By the way, before we get to you, hang with me. I just want to give out two websites, folks, because sometimes I get so caught up in the discussion with our guests, and Dave is a wonderful guest and a good friend and a former colleague. So let me give you folks two websites I would love for you to visit. One of them is my own website. If you're listening to the program, you probably are familiar with my website. It's michaelcutler.net, one word, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. And again, if you're familiar with what I do, I am a senior fellow with an organization called CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. And although they're on one end of the country and I'm on the other, we work well together. In fact, I had the wonderful opportunity to travel to Santa Barbara just a couple of weeks ago and did a couple of speaking engagements, which is something else that I like doing around the country, to have that discussion with our fellow Americans, because immigration really is a major factor in just about every challenge and threat that we face. And CAPS publishes a lot of great stuff on their website, including some of the commentaries that I've written. And their wonderful website, and I'd love for you to visit it, is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. So please go to my website, michaelcutler.net, or go to the CAPS Web website, because what I want you folks to do is to educate yourselves, because right now none of the politicians, or very few of them anyway, are really speaking honestly about the immigration issue. I've often joked, and I think Dave will agree with me, that probably the best candidate for the presidency right now, the way the world is and the way that our politicians tend to work, would probably be David Copperfield. At least then we would have a professional illusionist in the Oval Office. What say you, Dave Stoddard?
I think that's appropriate. It's very funny.
I thought you'd appreciate that. Why don't you tell my audience a little bit about your background so they'll know why I've invited you on, and we'll get started talking about the lunacy that passes for border security in this wacky era that we find ourselves in.
Oh, I'm fundamentally a Westerner. I was born in the Southwest, grew up in the Southwest when I was a kid. I used to work and play on the ranches. And during my recreation and work on the ranches, I used to run into Border Patrol officers quite often. And I often thought to myself that, well, these guys get paid for getting out in the brush and going through the weeds and hunting and that. What a great job. So after I got out of the Army, or actually before I got out of the Army, I saw an ad, Border Patrol recruitment, and so I filled out the application, sent it in, and I got discharged from the Army and got into the Border Patrol right away. That's where I spent my career. I spent 27 years in the Border Patrol, worked in California, Texas, Arizona, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, Florida, Puerto Rico.
Where haven't you been? Sounds like you took the scenic tour.
I've never been to New York, Mike.
Well, then you've been nowhere. We have to do something about that, Dave Stoddard. I'd love to play I'd love to play tour guide for you. As I will be, by the way, next week, one of the folks, one of the young ladies who works for CAPS, Melinda, is coming to New York, so I'm going to play tour guide for her, and I'd love to do the same for you when you come to New York. What do you think of that, Dave?
Oh, I think that's a wonderful invitation and an opportunity that at some point in my life I would like to take you up on it.
Well, I'd love to show you the Big Apple. You know, I have to tell you, it's amazing, and you've seen this firsthand as well. I've traveled all over this incredible country, and it really is an amazing country. I've been everywhere from Hawaii to Seattle to California to Texas to Maine and Vermont and Florida and every place in between, Chicago, Indiana, Alabama. And you look at the diversity of our country, and you look at the richness of the cultures, of the terrain. It's unbelievable. And I just think that the politicians in Washington should get their heads out of their backsides and understand the damage that they're doing to this incredible country, not by barring the door. I don't ever want to see our borders sealed, but in being careful that we don't let the bad guys in. Don't let in the terrorists, don't let in the criminals or the drug dealers, and don't create an environment where Americans are competing with foreign workers for jobs, and because of the foreign workers, we're hammering American wages. And you know this, I'm sure. Prior to the Second World War, immigration was the bailiwick of the Labor Department, because the big concern was that if you flood the labor market with lots of foreign workers, you will do exactly what we're seeing now. This is an experiment run amok. You drive down wages, and you wind up causing Americans to lose their jobs, their livelihoods, and their slim grasp on the American dream. Doesn't that sound reasonable? I know you and I both worked for the old INS, but wasn't that really always the focus of what the goal was? Protect American lives and jobs?
Absolutely, Mike. The adage, the mantra was to determine whether a person was illegal or not, the question was, is this person displacing American labor?
Yep.
And that was the focus of the entire operation, the entire border security. Of course, secondarily, ever since the days of Prohibition, a secondary objective was, of course, to keep contraband from crossing our borders. Primarily, it was illegal people.
Yep. And so here we are after 9/11, after the attack. By the way, you know, we just observed the 19th anniversary of the first attack at the World Trade Center, February of 1993, 19 years ago. And a month before that, we had this attack at the CIA by a guy by the name of Canty, a Pakistani national, who got political asylum from Pakistan by lying all over his application, committed fraud, got away with it, and he repaid America's kindness and consideration by standing outside CIA headquarters in January of 93 with an AK-47. He opened fire, killed two CIA officers and wounded three others, fled the country. We brought him back, put him on trial, found him guilty, and executed him. But again, as I've often pointed out, the people that he killed remain dead. The people that he injured remained injured. And we still have no integrity to the process by which we give out political asylum, and I do mean give out. It's supposed to be an adjudicative process, the word judge in there, that it's supposed to be done with great deliberation and consideration for facts. And we basically give away the store, and it's costing American lives. And now, of course, with the cartels picking up their activity in the United States, and that's really what I want to focus on with our conversation today, because I know you spent the greater part of your career on the southern border, and I know things have changed considerably since the days that you were part of the Green Machine, the Border Patrol. But what are you hearing, and where are you hearing it from, Dave? Because Dave and I had a wonderful conversation earlier this afternoon. We talk off-air as well as on-air, being the former colleagues and friends. And you were telling me about crimes of violence that are occurring that are related to the drug traffickers. And I'd love for you to explain to the audience what you started telling me this afternoon when I cut you off abruptly and said, Dave, hold on to that conversation. We need to share this with the folks who listen to my program. So here you are. Here they are. Now we can go for it. How does that sound?
Sure, Mike. And I'll need to lay some background for
your listeners. Want you to. That's exactly what I want. I want you to give this context, and only you can with your experience in the Border Patrol.
Historically, people migrated back and forth across the border, mainly to look for jobs. And there were people who lived in Mexico who would come into the United States in January, February of the year, and spend the entire year and return home in November, spend Christmas with their family, and then do the yearly migration routine year after year. They never caused anybody any harm. A lot of them were legal. The group that everyone's familiar with would be the Braceros. They were brought in legally. And after the Bracero program ended, the Braceros just continued to do their yearly migration, only they did it in an illegal status. They still went to Idaho with the potato harvest. They went to California for strawberries and oranges, citrus, and that sort of thing. And they went into the Midwest to work in the wheat harvest. And again, they really didn't do anybody any harm. They displaced American labor, theoretically, so therefore the Border Patrol and INS investigators were charged with identifying them, rounding them up, and repatriating them. And it was just I use the term normal routine. And starting late 70s, I would say, the marijuana traffickers started getting more and more prolific and more powerful, and they continued to do so, but they continued to move their product across the border. But there was somewhat of a truce, if you will, that they did. If they encountered a law enforcement officer, these traffickers would give up, admit their wrongdoing, serve their jail time, and return. There was very little violence. There was, of course, there was violence over competing drug rings, over routes and customers and that. But as far as law enforcement was affected, it was unusual for a drug trafficker to be armed, and even more unusual for him to actually use a weapon in an attempt to evade arrest. In the 90s, late 80s and 90s, all of that began to change. The drug traffickers, apparently, well, from what my intelligence sources tell me, they received orders from the higher-ups, from what then developed into cartels. From the heads of the cartels, they received orders to evade apprehension, to fight, to flee, and that's what they started doing. Flick the lights on a suspicious car, and all of a sudden the brake lights would come on, person do a U-turn, and then take off at 100 miles an hour or better back for the border. And frequently they were able to evade apprehension that way by just simply fleeing at high speed, knocking down fences, going through people's yards.
Sounds like what the moonshiners used to do in the during Prohibition, which is how you wound up with stock car racing, you know.
Oh, yes, exactly. Well, that's what the dope traffickers were doing. They're still doing it. But then in the early 90s, the United States started building fences, which did a great deterrent. The liberals like to say, well, the fence doesn't do any good, and you hear the mantra, you build a 15-foot fence and somebody builds a 16-foot ladder as if it doesn't make any difference. But I tell you something, Mike, when those fences went up, these high-speed chases came to a screeching halt. I'm talking about the cross-border
And by the way, you know, Israel did the same thing. If you remember, and, you know, I worked closely with the Israeli National Police for the better part of my career. I tripped over a PLO plot to blow up an Israeli refinery back in the mid-70s. We prevented the attack. So from that point on, I had a wonderful working relationship with the Israeli National Police. And they had those terrible bombings where the terrorist thugs would blow up bus stations and cafeterias and coffee shops and schools. And when they built the fence to gain control over that situation, the bombings in Israel stopped. Fences do work, don't they? Good fences make good neighbors, don't they?
The fences absolutely work, but as a unintended consequence of putting up the fences and barriers, the routes for passing dope into the United States became more rare and more rare.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the cartels moved in and started committing violence against one another over preferred routes and preferred methods and that. And that set off a huge amount of violence that's been going on now, really, for I don't know, 20 years or more. But
well, you know, one
in
the
last
factors, just to I hate to interrupt you, just to make one point. You know, I was assigned to the OCDEF unit, the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, and before that I was assigned to DEA Intelligence in New York. Back in the late 80s. there was a vice presidential task force in the Florida area. Because
I
they
was
were
there.
Using the Go Fast, you were, okay, so you're familiar with the Go Fast boats
yes.
that were coming in, and Miami Vice, basically, you could have been basing it off of what was happening. So when we suddenly were applying pressure in Florida, you know, a long time ago when I went before Congress, I said the whole issue of border security and immigration law enforcement is kind of like a big balloon, you know, squeeze one end, it bulges elsewhere. When we squeezed the end of the balloon, which was Miami, which is where a lot of the go-fast boats with the dope were coming in, they also shifted to the land border between Mexico and the United States. So I think that also contributed to the phenomenon that you're describing. Would you agree with my assessment?
Yes, I would. And it, the phenomenon kept building to the point that the cartels today have taken over practically all the traffic across our borders. There
and they've also
supplanted
the Colombians. You know, the Colombians for a while were running the show, and they gave it over to the Mexicans. I guess they figured we'll give up some of our profit, but also insulate ourselves from law enforcement.
Well, it works.
Uh-huh.
But where there used to be two separate traffickers, illegal alien traffickers and the dope traffickers, they were separate, and usually they cooperated with one another and didn't conflict with one another. But over the last few years, that distinction has been eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening now, like, for example, the area where I live, south of me, is controlled by the Sinaloa cartel. Well, the Sinaloa cartel is moving dope, and they're also moving illegal aliens. Only now they're holding illegal aliens captive on both sides of the border, demanding ransom from families on both sides of the border. And any person who wants to engage in alien trafficking has to be cleared by the Sinaloa cartel. And they have been very extremely violent. We're talking beheadings, dismemberments, people machine gunned to death with numerous bullets from fully automatic AK-47s and that. And this violence has not confined itself to Mexico. I mean, it's going on right now from Matamoros to Tijuana.
And
it's
Matamoros
going on right
is
now.
Place I'm familiar with because I went to the old Border Patrol Academy in Los Fresnos, Texas, in Brownsville, which is right across the border from Matamoros.
Yeah, that's where I went too, Mike.
See that?
But this violence continues to escalate, and I've heard Janet Napolitano and who knows who, Alan Burson, and probably David Aguilar at one time or another,
uh-huh.
made public statements.
David
that,
Aguilar, head of the Border Patrol.
Made statements that the violence has not spilled over across their border, the cartel violence. And I'm here to tell you that it has. We've had beheadings north of the border. We've had aliens on the freeways get into gun battles with one another on Interstate 10.
That's
here we've
in the
had,
United States. That's on the American side of the border.
Yes, sir. And
you know what's remarkable, Dave? Again,
yes.
You know, when I was at DEA intelligence, and this is 25 years ago, I started to look at the statistics about who we were arresting. I was reviewing arrest records. Back then in New York City, 60% of the people we were arresting for drug trafficking were identified as foreign-born. And the violence that we saw in New York more than two decades ago was unlike anything that we had seen domestically previously, because there is a culture of violence that goes with other countries. And this isn't about being a bigot or a xenophobe or anything, folks, but different countries have different values, different standards. And when you live in countries where violence and corruption passes for business as usual, the folks who come here from those countries will bring those values or lack of values with them. Is that an unreasonable statement, Dave?
It's absolutely not an unreasonable statement, and furthermore, I can tell you without a doubt that the Mexican drug trafficking organizations, they're called DTOs now, have set up networks in every major city in the USA. We're talking L.A., Denver, Seattle, Chicago, Albuquerque, Atlanta, New York even.
Yep.
And this is a proven fact, but our politicians want to keep it swept under the rug and not admit it and go on television and tell the American people that there's been no spillover and violence. Yet cities like, well, for example, Lincoln, Nebraska, for the first time ever are getting gang graffiti, drive-by shootings, and illegal aliens selling meth and cocaine,
and you know what's
heroin.
And you know what's remarkable? If you watch the TV, the food police are out in force. Just, I guess, a week or two ago, I believe it was Fox News reported on how an 8-year-old girl wound up having her salami and cheese sandwich confiscated. For those of you who haven't heard the story, I kid you not, folks, you can't make this up. Welcome to the Twilight Zone. Her teacher took her salami sandwich because it wasn't good nutritional food and made her eat chicken nuggets. I mean, I don't know where the improvement was, but remarkably, with all this talk about too much salt in our diet and too much sugar in our diet, have you ever seen, or at least in recent years, any commercials for the other white powders, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, any of those drugs? I haven't seen a single public service announcement about that, but we're bombarded almost daily about stuff in dealing with nutrition. Are you feeling? Are you seeing the same thing in your neck of the woods?
I haven't seen any anti-drug ads since Nancy Reagan.
Isn't that remarkable?
Just say no.
They did this is your brain on drugs with the frying pan and the egg.
Mm-hmm. I haven't
and you haven't
seen
any
then.
Either. Now, what I want to know is this. Why in God's name are we emphasizing, or are the powers that be, whoever they are, salt and sugar being evil, but not a word about cocaine that's being snorted or heroin that's being injected being even more evil and even more worrisome? And yet we're being told there's a war on drugs. We talked off air. We both lost colleagues and friends to this war on drugs, but not a word about the dangers of drugs to the general public. Doesn't this seem awfully twisted and bizarre to you?
It's upside down, Mike. We've got the First Lady complaining about trans fatty
trans fats
substances and
that,
and yet on the nightly news you see pictures of meth addicts with their mouths all raw and their teeth falling out, and they look like skin-covered skeletons, and nothing is being done about that. The priority is people are obese, not the American public, percentage of the American public is addicted.
Whitney Houston just died because of her involvement with drugs. Other celebrities have died, and the beat goes on. And you still don't see any real emphasis warning kids, hey, this isn't a good thing. Stay away from this garbage. You really have to wonder where the drug money is ultimately going and who's profiting from all of this, don't you?
Oh, I do. I do. I'm sorry, Mike, but I have become pessimistic and cynical. I'm beginning to
How
think
could that,
that
ever happen? How could that ever happen, Dave Stoddard?
Oh, man, it took me many years, but it has happened. I keep seeing evidence of corruption, admitted corruption, and people who you and I would never have suspected have turned out to be corrupt, just as corrupt as the drug dealer on the street.
You know, it's funny because I've often made the point that we were not allowed to accept so much as a cup of coffee when we were on duty. And yet the politicians take with both hands and boast about it. Could you imagine if you went to your chief patrol agent or if I went to my assistant district director for investigations and said, boy, you should be proud of me. I'm the best fundraiser in the district. How do you think that would have played in the Border Patrol?
You'd have been up on charges.
I mean, how quick, right? And meanwhile, these guys are taking with both hands. And when they brag about it, their supporters standing behind them clap like a bunch of trained seals, don't they?
Mike, we've got John Morton, head of ICE. He's making the policies.
If you're not familiar with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, go ahead.
And John Morton, of course, he takes orders directly from Cecilia Munoz, who is a former head of La Raza, who's in the Obama White House. But nevertheless, we've got John Morton, who's has been documented. He's taken free football tickets, tickets to the Oscars, and getting all these bennies and stuff. When in the old days, when you and I were officers, Mike, we'd have been up on charges and fired.
You know, I know of an agent who I won't even mention which office, because I think he might still be on the job, and I don't want to create a problem, because I'm certain that there are folks in Washington who listen to this program. But I know that this guy had pulled to the curb on his way home from the office, and the rule was you were not allowed to use the government car for personal errands or anything like that. It was this purely for your own official use. But the cars went home with us so that we were available 24/7. So this guy was authorized to take a car home. I want you to picture this. He is on his way home. It's pouring out. He normally likes to go to the gym near his house and work out regularly, stay in good shape. I mean, the job is a physical job. You're involved in tackling people, arresting them, and so forth. And so he pulls to the curb, doesn't even drive out of the way, goes into the gym, which is directly en route from his from the office to his house, works out, gets back in the car. Unbeknownst to him, his supervisor saw him getting back into the car. They charged him with misusing a government vehicle. The guy had been an agent for many years. They wrote him up for being for firing. Eventually, they mitigated it down to either a 30- or a 60-day suspension and a demotion of one grade for misusing a vehicle. And what was it that he did? He stopped at the curb, walked into the gym, worked out, got back in the car, and continued on his way home. And meanwhile, you know, you look at what the folks at the, in the so-called leadership positions get away with as a matter of routine. How disgusting is this?
Absolutely disgusting, Mike. And I know of cases like you just mentioned as simply stopping at a grocery store on the way home from a checkpoint and picking up a gallon of milk to take home. And, you know, people get fired for that, or they have gotten fired.
Yep. Could you imagine that, folks? We are talking about a standard that the field agent must adhere to or else. And then you just go a couple of steps up the ladder, and you see abuses that would leave your head spinning like a top. You know, it was remarkable. I was watching Nancy Pelosi chastising Detroit, the executives, when they had that hearing about how they had flown to Washington on those corporate jets. And I got to tell you, I'm a taxpayer. I did not see anything wrong with an executive flying in his corporate jet to Washington. I do a lot of traveling. When you look at the process of going through the check-in, and if a flight gets in, comes in late, you leave late, you're tied up at the airport, these guys make a lot of money an hour. Every hour needs to be as productive as possible for the stockholders and for the people who work for the company and so forth. So having your own airplane at your disposal is a very effective business tool. It's a legitimate deal. And here's Nancy Pelosi, who's flying around the country on a 737 that cost the taxpayers gazillions of dollars, screaming about how these Detroit executives dared to fly to Washington. I guess she expected them to hitchhike? I mean, what we're looking at is a level of hypocrisy that I think is unfathomable. Am I getting this wrong, Dave?
No, you're not, Mike. You're right on the money there.
You know, folks, we get the government we deserve. We really do. And I hope there's a lot of you out there listening to what Dave has to say, to what I have to say. But listening to us isn't enough if you're not taking the next step. And the next step is being a very good employer. Because we are the employers of these folks in Washington who allege to represent us. Now, we do have some decent representatives. But boy, oh boy, for the most part, I would take these folks and just throw them out the door and say, get a real job. And part of the problem is that we, the people, have been sitting down and watching television and playing Xbox and doing everything but taking our responsibilities as members of a democratic republic seriously. We have really got to get involved. We really have to make our voices heard. And I'm not trying to defend politicians. But if they're supposed to represent us, how on earth can they represent us if we don't tell them what we want and what we expect? We don't go to a restaurant, and for those of you old enough to remember Johnny Carson playing the Mighty Karnak, where he held the envelope to his forehead, and Ed McMahon would divine what the question was that was contained in the envelope. We don't go to a restaurant, hold a menu to our head, and hope that the waiter is going to figure out what we want. We're very specific. You know, I want a cheeseburger, and I want it with Swiss cheese, not cheddar cheese, and so forth. Well, you know what, folks? We have got to be at least as specific with the folks who purport to represent us, whether it's in City Hall, the state capitol, and most certainly in Congress. And that's why this program is here, because after 9/11, after witnessing that horrific day, you know, for me, it wasn't just my country that was attacked, and certainly it was our country that was attacked, but it was my hometown. The ashes landed on me, landed on my neighborhood, and contained the remains of many of my neighbors. And to see my neighbors wandering the streets the night of 9/11 in tears, screaming, lost. They had no idea where they were. They lost their wives and their husbands and their children and their parents and their siblings and their best friends. I never want to live through something like that again. And it was preventable if the Clinton administration had only learned the lessons that they should have learned from those two terrorist attacks that were committed just over 19 years ago. You know, we won the Second World War in 44 months. We were attacked at Pearl Harbor, and in 44 months, and we weren't a superpower, and not all of our allies were truly allies. I mean, think about what happened right after the war with Russia, and we immediately went into the Berlin airlift, and then we had the Korean War. So, but we worked with Russia, we worked with France, we worked with England, and we did what we had to do. And in 44 months, we built fleets of airplanes that had never existed before, fleets of ships that had never existed before, radar installations, bazookas, tanks, atom bombs. We did whatever was necessary, and in 44 months, it was over. 19 years after the World Trade Center darn near came down sideways, and it probably would have killed hundreds of thousands, would probably have left lower Manhattan still uninhabitable had that happened, and we're still jerking around saying, well, maybe we'll build a fence, maybe we'll do something about immigration. We keep expanding the visa waiver program. Every day more illegal aliens come here. We have no way of knowing who they are or why they're here or where they're from. And just to put a real ribbon around it, and I'm sure you've been following this as I have, Dave, Iran has shock troops, the Quds as they're known, stationed in Venezuela. There are training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil, whether it's Hamas, Al-Qaeda, or Hezbollah, located in Brazil in the tri-border region right near the borders of Argentina and Paraguay. And President Obama, just about a month ago, appropriately enough, went to Disney World, you got to love it, and talked about his plans to include Brazil in the countries that participate in this wacky, dangerous, I mean really dangerous, visa waiver program so we can encourage more trade, because this is what the Chamber of Commerce wants. And so you look at all of that, and you say to yourself, what will it really take? You know, the World Trade Center, which was the pinnacle of the lower Manhattan skyline, it was the crown jewel of lower Manhattan, was obliterated along with 3,000 people who were killed immediately. Many more folks, probably close to 20,000, by the way, are still suffering. Some of them have perished because of the toxins that they ingested and were exposed to when those buildings came down. So you would think after something on that magnitude, the Pentagon was attacked. Another airplane went down in Pennsylvania. I mean, this was a serious, coordinated attack. This wasn't spray paint graffiti. This wasn't a couple of firecrackers or a brick through the window. We're talking about two towers that stood 110 stories tall, reduced to rubble, along with the people who occupied those buildings, along with other buildings that were part of that complex, and we still can't seem to focus on the task at hand? And we call ourselves a superpower?
Now, Mike, it's even more asinine.
Forgive my rant, by the way, Dave, but every time I think about it, my guts twist. I've got to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, every time I think about it, Mike, and maybe your listeners are already aware of what I'm about to say.
Hey, go ahead.
But all 19 of those hijackers were illegal aliens.
That's right.
And
violated the visa process. They committed fraud. They all lied to inspectors.
And had existing laws, existing immigration laws been enforced, they wouldn't have even been in the country.
That's right.
Now, that's what really irritates me.
Well, it's insane. And again, we know that the terrorists who attacked us in 1993 all gamed the visa process. Mahmoud Abu Alima and his brother had both been given agricultural amnesty a la Chuck Schumer. And they they never worked on a farm. The only thing that those two bums ever planted was a bomb in the garage of the World Trade Center. So you would have thought that the lesson would have been learned by the Clinton administration. You know, when you watch the television, or God forbid you've had a serious crime committed in your home or in your neighborhood or with a friend or a relative, you know, crime scene comes out. Now, one of the first questions the detectives or the insurance people want to know is, how did the bad guy get into the premises in order to do the damage? Did he break in? Did he come through the window? Did he come through the skylight? Did he steal a key? Was the door left open? Was the door left unlocked? Did he use a subterfuge to get the homeowner to open the door? You know, these are all the questions that get asked, because the first question is, how did he gain access? Well, with a terrorist attack, it's the same deal. How did they manage to enter the United States? In fact, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. And almost each and every one of these thugs, of these sociopathic SOBs, got into the country by gaming the visa process and by committing fraud and by violating the immigration laws. And in fact, May 20th of 1997, Lamar Smith, who is currently the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, invited me to participate in my first congressional hearing because of those two terrorist attacks of 93. And the focus of the hearing, folks, was visa fraud and immigration benefit application fraud, because they understood, the Congress certainly understood, that it was through the visa process, through the way that we adjudicate applications for various immigration benefits, including U.S. citizenship, that enabled the terrorists to enter the United States and enabled them, to use the jargon of the 9/11 Commission, to embed themselves. I call it hiding in plain sight. And you know what the Clinton administration did while Congress was holding hearings about the flaws in the system? They created this nightmare known as Citizenship USA, where they ran over a million applications for U.S. citizenship through the process so quickly that it reminded me of Lucy at the Bon Bon Factory, if you remember that hilarious episode, except there was nothing funny about this. They naturalized over a million aliens, and afterwards the GAO, responding to complaints from immigration employees, came in, did an investigation, and you know what they found? That thousands of these folks not only should never have been given citizenship, the highest honor we could bestow on them, they should have been deported. Thousands. Now, you look at that and you say, did they learn the lessons of 93? Well, absolutely not. And you know what this led to? It led to the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Am I getting any of this wrong in your experience, Dave?
No. As far as I can see, you're exactly right.
So now where have we learned the lessons now? We just observed the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Meanwhile, you know, Richard Reed, for those of you who travel, you know the routine. We do the little dance. Off come the shoes, out come the keys, off comes the coat. You know, I've got it down to a science now. I do it often enough. Richard Reed is the reason we take our shoes off. Now, to show you how bass-ackwards this whole deal is, we take our shoes off because we figured it out. You can conceal bombs in your shoes. By the way, they've now figured out that they can also conceal bombs in your underwear. Think of Captain Underpants, who almost brought down a plane over Detroit. And I joked about it, but it's nothing funny. I said probably the next thing will be the federal wedgie or something. But the point is, we have to take our shoes off because of Richard Reed. Well, Richard Reed, by the way, folks, was a citizen, or is a citizen, of Great Britain, which meant he did not need a visa in order to get on board the airplane. And if you remember that other guy, Massawi, the so-called 20th hijacker, citizen of France, he came here, also did not need a visa to enter the United States or to get on board an airplane. And you know what's incredible? Our government learned that you can conceal a bomb in your shoes, and that's why we take our shoes off. But the fact that this guy could get on an airplane without first applying for and receiving a visa, they know it, but the reaction has been to not only not end the visa waiver program, but to expand it so that now we are up to 35 countries whose citizens don't need to get visas to come here. Now, understand what this means. And I want to be clear about this, by the way, folks. Just because someone is a citizen of Pakistan or another one of those countries that we consider special interest, a country that might be associated with terrorism, doesn't mean that everybody from Pakistan or Ethiopia or any of those countries is necessarily a bad guy. Let's be clear about this. But certainly these are folks who need to undergo a little bit greater scrutiny. In England, you have hundreds of thousands of naturalized Pakistani citizens. They are now dual nationals. They have Pakistani passports. They have British passports. This gives them the ability to travel around the world and cover their tracks. They can travel, for example, from England to a neutral country like Germany on the British passport, conceal the British passport, take out the Pakistani passport, fly to the Middle East, fly anywhere they want to go, come back into Germany on that Pakistani passport, conceal that, return home to England on the British passport. They will have covered the tracks in terms of where they went on the Pakistani passport. And they can come to the United States on that British passport without getting a visa because they are British nationals with British passports, so they don't need a visa to come to the United States. And a visa can be very helpful to provide 40 investigative leads, because that's how many questions they have to answer before they can get a visa. They leave a record of their fingerprints and their photos, so even if they don't get the visa, we have the application, so we have on file a name and a biometric and their photographs. It could be very helpful to keep terrorists off of airplanes and keep terrorists out of the United States. And guess what? The great majority of people who are coming here as non-immigrants for a temporary period now enter the United States without being required to get a visa first. But the TSA, they will grope 85-year-old women. And I look at this lunacy that we call national security, and it is kabuki theater. It is a charade. It is theater of the worst kind, because in my judgment, while I agree with a lot of the measures that they're doing, because I certainly never want to get a window seat on a cruise missile, so to speak. I don't want to be on a hijacked plane that gets used that way. I also want the system to have real integrity, and I want us to do things that make sense. And there is so many things that I look at with my 30 years of experience. I've worked on terrorism investigations, and I got to tell you, folks, it leaves me scratching my head and quite frankly ticks me off in ways you can't begin to imagine. It's remarkable, isn't it, Dave?
Yes, it is, Mike, and it bothers me that our government is focusing on the method. They're focusing on shoes, underwear, and who knows what all else, when they should be focusing on the bomber,
yep,
not the method. And the bombers have all been from a certain area of the world, of certain ethnic groups, and speaking certain languages, and yet they will harass and terrify 6-year-old girls trying to board a plane. It doesn't make any sense to me. The liberals in this country, the political groups, have a mantra about no, we will not profile. Well, profiling is an essential part of law enforcement. Profiling is identifying the enemy, identifying the suspect.
And you know what's so funny, and this leads me to another point that I've been hammering away at, and it was a great segue. I guess you're reading my mind today, Dave. I guess great minds think alike. Think of the profiling that's done by journalists when they talk about the black vote, the Latino vote, the Jewish vote, this vote, that vote. Isn't that profiling? And isn't it bigotry? How can you say, well, Mike Cutler's Jewish, so therefore we know who he's going to vote for? Or Jose is Latino, we know who he's going to vote for. And if you want a Latino vote, by the way, then you have to vote for open borders, a pathway to citizenship for millions of illegal aliens who can't even prove who they are. And we want to provide the DREAM Act that would provide economic opportunities that we don't even provide for our own American kids. And by the way, folks, just again so you understand this is very deceptive, because we keep on hearing that the DREAM Act is to help children. Well, all it requires is that the alien be no older than 35 when he files the application, and that he claims that he entered the United States when he was no older than 14. He had to have gotten here before his 15th birthday. That's the DREAM Act. But it's not about people that are no older than 15 filing. It's that they have to claim they got here before they were 15 or 16, whatever the magic number is going to be, but they have until their 35th birthday to file to participate. And you know, I bet you know this, Dave. The reason that they picked 35 is if you look at the demographics of illegal aliens, that would cover about 90% of the illegals who are currently present in the United States. So
90% or more.
I'm sorry?
Or maybe more of the percent.
Or maybe more. It would certainly cover the great majority, almost all of them. So that's why this is being done. It's a jury-rigged operation to try to take American kindness, compassion, and decency and use it against us. But if you're here as an American citizen, whether you're of Latino background or any other background, this is against your own best interests. And in fact, illegal aliens who run the border very often are involved in criminal activities. It's not to say that the majority of illegals are criminals, but you have a very significant population of members of MS-13 and other transnational gangs, and the FBI estimates there's about 1.4 million active gang members in America. If only a third of them are aliens, think how many we're talking about, and I suspect that it's more than a third. But let's even go with a third. You're talking about nearly a half million people. So if you look at that number and you say to yourself, well, if we're talking about Latino gangs, guess who Latino gangs want to recruit into their organizations to become other gang members? They are very aware of ethics, of ethnics, so they will bring in members of the same ethnicity. MS-13 is not going to recruit white kids. MS-13 is not going to recruit black kids. MS-13 actively recruits members of the Latino community. So if you are a United States citizen and you are of Hispanic or Latino origins, it's against your best interest to want to have open borders because your children are being placed at risk for gang recruitment, and you living in that ethnic community are at greatest risk for being attacked by violent gang members. So we hear this mythology, the profiling being done by the journalists. Oh, if you want that mythical Latino vote, you have to vote for all these things that would let lots more illegal aliens in, who, by the way, guess who they're competing with for the jobs? American citizens, often of the same ethnicity. And nobody has the guts, or as we say in Brooklyn, the chutzpah, to stand up and say, what on earth are you folks talking about? Why would anybody of any ethnicity who's a United States citizen or a lawful immigrant be in favor of witnessing a flood of illegal aliens coming across that border where we have no way of knowing who they are or why they're here, and undoubtedly it would include members of gangs and criminal organizations? Would you disagree with my hypothesis, Dave?
Mike, let me tell you, here where I live, I am surrounded by what you call Latinos.
Okay.
These guys and these people, these men and women and kids, are Mexican-Americans. They go back in America sometimes 3 or 4 or 5 generations.
Yep.
And they live all around me, and I don't know any of them who are in favor of open borders and amnesty. Not a one.
Isn't that remarkable? I mean, you know,
well,
Al Garza. Do you know Al Garza?
Oh, absolutely. Al Garza and I are practically neighbors.
Okay, and Al, you know, is of Tex-Mex background, as they call themselves. He was a United States Marine Corps member, very proud of it, and I'm very proud to consider Al a good friend. And I will tell you, if you want to light Al Garza's fuse, just tell him, ask him what he thinks about these wacky programs. He lights up like the 4th of July. So, you know, here's my point, folks. I am asking you to please get a hold of your elected representatives and let them understand what the world looks like to you. They are operating under a misconception that's being promulgated by people making tons of money off of the exploitation of illegal aliens and also through the destruction of America's middle class that really was the engine that made America the success story and the envy of the world that it became.
And I can tell you who those people are who are profiting off of that.
Go ahead. Let's hear it.
Organizations like LULAC, MALDEF, La Raza, MAPA, and those groups who get government handouts to help alleviate the ills of Latinos and that, who are actually Marxist, and they're furthering poverty, they're furthering dependency on the government, and those are the ones who are profiting off of what you just mentioned.
And you know what's so remarkable? Everyone says the liberals. I'm registered as a Democrat my whole life. I can't tell you the last time I voted for a Democrat for national office, because I think that that party has gone completely off the rails. But if you're pro-labor, and I am, my dad was a construction worker. He was a plumber. He was my biggest hero in the universe. And all those guys are. You know, you look at blue-collar, hard-working Americans who aren't afraid to get their hands dirty, who go out there and do dangerous, back-breaking, filthy work as a matter of routine. They built this country. And they are being undermined by day laborers. They're being undermined by this massive influx of illegal aliens. And then as you go up the economic ladder, we're bringing in the high-tech workers at the other end of the spectrum, undermining American engineers and scientists and technicians and professionals. And we're doing this so that corporations can make out like bandits. And I got to tell you, most of these so-called American corporations are American in name only. Many of them don't pay taxes to the United States. They import foreign workers, and they build factories and other facilities outside the United States. So if that's what a company does, then I want to know how on earth we still consider it to be an American company. So understand what's happening because of political campaign contributions, folks. Understand that these politicians are taking the contributions with expectations that they will deliver for those contributions. And what this is doing is destroying America's middle class. It's taking the American dream and making it almost impossible for most Americans. This is the first generation of Americans in many generations, folks, where the current generation has a reduced expectation of success as compared with the generation that preceded them. The American dream, in part, was that each generation would do better through higher education and achieving greater skills and greater successes. That is becoming increasingly impossible as we are being undermined by open borders and the presence of millions of foreign workers, both legal and illegal, in the United States, who have an unfair advantage over the American workers that they displace. So this is why this issue is so important. And this is why I do this program every week, because my job, is, as I see it, and it's a job, believe me, even though I don't get paid to do the radio show. This is a labor of love for a country that I love. But I'm doing this because I am trying to educate as many of our fellow Americans as possible as to exactly what it is that's going wrong. And you know what? I know that, in fact, I was just on a local TV show. We were talking about the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street crowd. And let me tell you what, in some ways they may be polar opposites, but at the end of the day, you're looking at two groups of people that looked at the landscape and said, something is terribly wrong. Now, they may not admit that they share common ground, but they do. The common ground that they share is that they've come to the realization that the American dream is going the way of the dodo bird. They've come to the realization that what used to be taken for granted, our freedoms as Americans, are being whittled away almost daily in the name of national security. And meanwhile, the quality of life in this country is going down the hopper. And we've got to stand up and we've got to make our voices heard, folks. There's an election coming in November. Between now and then, I want you involved in the process. And what I want you to do, and if you can write this down, that's great. And if not, you can go to my website, michaelcutler.net, and Caps Web, I believe, has it up also, capsweb.org. Here are the four questions I want you to ask these presidential candidates if you're at a town hall meeting. I want you to ask these questions of that next candidate for Congress that you meet with. Number one, what would you do with the lawsuit filed by the administration, by the Justice Department, against Arizona, Alabama, South Carolina, and any other state that would dare to enact its own immigration laws? Would you continue with the lawsuit? Would you end it? Question one. Question number two, would you continue to encourage high-tech workers through H-1B visas and other similar programs to continue to come to America and take high-tech jobs that Americans desperately need? There was just an article in the New York Times about how there aren't enough training opportunities for Americans to take the jobs. Well, I don't buy that argument, but if that is the case, why isn't the government seeking to create facilities and opportunities for Americans? It's a hell of a lot better to spend the money there than to have to keep on extending unemployment benefits to people that can't survive in this era. Number three, we have about 60,000 plus TSA, Transportation Safety Administration employees, groping 85-year-old women at airports. Now, I'm not blaming them. They're doing the job they're paid to do. I blame Washington for this mess. We're being irradiated by machines that, in part, are owned by companies linked to former high members of the administration. It's a ripoff in many ways. My question here, we only have about 7,000 ICE agents, more than half of whom are doing customs work. So that means that we've got about 3,000, if we're lucky, immigration agents, so-called, doing immigration work. I say so-called because they're not looking to deport people the way they had been. They're not enforcing the laws. They do silent raids, so they go after employers, not the illegals, and so forth. So what I want to know is, if you're elected, would you go against that trend? Maybe have parity, as many immigration agents as TSA employees, and give them whatever support measures are necessary so that we can put some teeth back into immigration law enforcement and in so doing discourage this human tsunami that crashes on our shores on a daily basis. And finally, you need to ask them what they would do about sanctuary cities. The law says that if you aid, abet, encourage, or induce an alien to enter the United States in violation of law or remain in violation of law, or you harbor or shield them from detection from federal authorities, that you're committing a felony. Well, if you just think about what I said and you think about how sanctuary cities operate, those cities are committing felonies on a daily basis. What I'd like to know, would you be willing to end funding for law enforcement for those cities and states that continue on with sanctuary policies? And would you be willing to push for the prosecution of local officials who refuse to honor detainers that are lodged by ICE? A detainer, if you're not familiar with it, is a document that you give to the warden of a prison, for example, that says Joe Smith is a suspected illegal alien. We must be notified. ICE must be notified before you turn this guy loose. We don't want him on the street. We want to take custody of him. There are places where they are not making those phone calls. So these criminal aliens are going back out on the street where they continue to pose a threat to the safety of the communities where they are. So what I want to know is, if it can be shown that an official intentionally ignored a detainer, would you be willing to see that guy arrested and prosecuted for obstruction of federal governmental administration? These are the real questions. Everyone asks about the border. We know the story. Every politician that knows what he has to say will tell you that he favors National Guard on the border and wants to put up a fence, and maybe will even offer to electrify it for you if it'll make you smile. So we've got to get beyond the border down in the Southwest. As important as that border is, this is a multifaceted crisis, and I want to pin these politicians down where they stand. Do you have any other questions you would ask Dave Stoddard?
No, sir, and you've covered it quite adeptly. But, Mike, I hate to be a party pooper, but my time is up, and I got to go. It's been a pleasure being with you, and hopefully you'll have me back.
Dave Stoddard, I will always have you back, and I got to tell you, it was delightful to end my week having you on the program. As usual, you really provided some important insight and experience, and I appreciate your help, and I appreciate your friendship.
Well, thank you, Mike, and one final statement I'd like to make. You've been essentially what you've been talking about the last few minutes is interior enforcement.
You bet.
And you spent your career in interior enforcement. I spent my career on border enforcement, but let me tell your listeners, if you have effective interior enforcement, there's no need for the border enforcement because people will quit coming in. They'll realize there's no sense in trying to run the dope, no sense in trying to scam the system, that they're not going to be successful, so they won't bother jumping our border.
Well, you know, I'll just say this before you bail out. If you remember when I was on Lou Dobbs a long time ago, I said nobody would break into the amusement park if they couldn't get to go on the rides.
Exactly. But thanks a lot, Mike, and thank you for being my friend, and it's been a pleasure being with you. Thank you very much.
Have a wonderful weekend, Dave, and I'll speak with you soon. Folks, that was Dave Stoddard, a good friend and a former colleague and a great American. It was delightful having him join us. And what I'm going to continue to do every week when I'm able to is to bring you guests like Dave Stoddard and some other folks, because my goal is to provide you with the kind of insight, not speculation by somebody who's just, you know, speculating because he has a wild idea that popped into his head last Thursday, but people who really were on the ground, who have the experience, whose opinions are really worth listening to. Immigration is not a single issue, but a singular issue, because it impacts so many of the challenges that confront the United States and confront our citizens today. It's a very important issue, and it's a fundamental issue. You know, think back to when you studied geography in school. The first thing we learned about are borders. Which country borders on what country? If we eliminate a country's borders, we eliminate the country, basically. I think it was Ronald Reagan who said, a country without borders is no country. I have a slightly different saying. I tell people that a country without secure borders can no more stand than can a house without walls. But the idea is the same. It's not xenophobic to want to make certain that you don't allow the bad guys in. It's not xenophobic to say that I want to make certain that American families of every race, every religion, and every ethnicity have the opportunity to be successful before we bring in more foreign workers. It's wonderful to be charitable, but there's a great saying that says that charity begins at home. There is no reasonable family that would feed homeless people before they feed their own children. In fact, if you tried to do that, the likely outcome would be the authorities would come and take your kids and say that you don't deserve to be a parent because you got your priorities screwed up. If our country does not make the American hardworking citizens of this country the first priority of the government, then this is no longer, in the eloquent words of President Abraham Lincoln, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. The only way that a government can meet that requirement as laid out by President Lincoln is to make certain that Americans get first shot at the jobs, that Americans get first shot at education, that Americans get first shot at opportunities. All Americans, irrespective of race, irrespective of religion, irrespective of ethnicity. This isn't about one flavor over another flavor. The other side will tell you that because they have no other arguments. The other side will use deceptive language and get all upset when you use the word alien. The term alien, and I will repeat this as many times as I have to get it driven home, the term alien is not a pejorative. It's not an insult. It's not the N-word, as they say. The term alien is a legal term, and under the law, the term alien simply means any person who is not a citizen or national of the United States. And I defy anybody to tell me where the insult is. See, the problem with the word alien, and there is a problem with it, is that it provides clarity to the debate. And the folks who stand to profit by open borders and the presence of millions upon millions of illegal aliens in our country understand one fundamental fact. They cannot win the debate unless they are deceptive in their use of language, unless they use the bullying tactic of name-calling and insulting people and so forth. We're better than that, folks. We're Americans. And I don't care what your race, your religion, or your ethnicity is. At the end of the day, we must be united as Americans. You know, I live in New York City, the most ethnically diverse city in the United States, arguably in the world. It's a great town. I couldn't imagine living anywhere else. This isn't about xenophobia. It's just about making certain that our immigration laws are enforced to protect our country, because that, at the end of the day, is the reason for the laws, to protect American lives, protect American jobs, to protect the American way of life. There's nothing unreasonable about it, and every other country on the face of the planet seeks to do the same thing for its own people. But we have been sold out, literally and figuratively, by too many of our supposed elected representatives who aren't really representing us. We really should find out who they are representing. So, you know, this is why I'm here. I hope that you've enjoyed the last hour and 15 minutes. Time flies when you're having fun, and Dave Stoddard is a wonderful guest and a good friend. And again, my goal is to make things informative for you so you can go out there and be the best American you can be. As I always like to point out, folks, I want you to remember that democracy is not a spectator sport. And what I mean by that is that you really need to be a participant in our government. You need to do everything possible to keep the politicians accountable, to make certain that they know that we are not as dumb as they hoped we are. Good night, everybody. I wish you all a wonderful weekend, and I look forward to joining you again next Friday at the same time. Again, please check out my website, michaelcutler.net. Please go to capsweb.org, and I'll see you next week. Good night.